We are very pleased to be able to present. We've been talking about lions and elephants and tigers, and I don't know exactly what animal Mr. Gephardt is, but he's one of those big, ferocious ones. I do know that as it relates to his 28 years of congressional service, his role as a majority leader in passing legislation in health care, pension, energy independence, education, is really never been duplicated, and he is has been a great advisor, consigliere, mentor, and reality check on Patrick and I as we have gone forward in this effort to try to bring this one mind thing together. Since leaving Congress, he's done a number of wonderful things. He has formed Gephardt Government Affairs, but in addition to that, he is the chairman of the Council for Medical Innovation, as well as the council or chairman of the Scripps Institute. And he's got some very interesting perspectives for us as we wrap up and to think about the future of medical innovation. So please welcome Dick Gephardt.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here today. I'm always happy to be introduced so you know who I am. One of the things that happens to you when you're in public life for as long as I was on C-SPAN and CNN is thereafter when you leave, you go out in restaurants and airports, people see you, they know they've seen you somewhere before, but they have a real problem guessing who I really am. It happens to me every day. A fellow came up the other day and he said, "I'm from Washington, D.C., and I know you." He said, you did the news on Channel 7 or you did the weather on Channel 4. Bob Ryan. Another great story, there were two women in an airport, St. Louis, where I'm from, and they were having a dispute about who I really am. I could see it. They finally came over to me and said, "We have a bet, $5. We're having a dispute about who you are. We know you're somebody, but you got to decide it." She said, "I think you're Dan Quayle." She said, "My friend here thinks you do the weather on CNN." It always comes back to the weather. So maybe I ought to do that. I don't know. The final story is the best. I'm going through the TSA line in the Atlanta airport. TSA worker woman staring a hole through me. Finally, my stuff's coming through the X-ray. She looks up at me and she says, "I've been looking at you and trying to remember who you are." And she said, "I finally remembered." I said, "Great. Who am I?" She said, "You played Batman in the last Batman movie." You cannot make these stories up. So I'm thrilled to be here today to be a small, small part of what I believe to be one of the most important efforts in the history of the United States. Patrick, Garen, and the others who have worked on this wanted to model it or to frame it against the example of JFK's challenge to the country to go to the moon. And just like that, I think probably a lot of people will look at this and say, "That's unlikely, can't happen, too many moving parts, too difficult, too much politics, too much money, too much. And they'll give up before they start. JFK got the country to not give up before we started, and we all know the rest of the story. Patrick Kennedy, my friend, my great friend, is playing in the same role with regard to a challenge which is probably a little tougher probably a little more complicated, probably a little more impossible than putting a human being on the moon, was when JFK announced that in his historic speech. But Patrick Kennedy, I know, will play this role even better than his uncle did, and he will lead us, this country, to unraveling the mysteries of the human brain and solving the many, many problems that we face from neurological conditions and diseases. Patrick, you're the man. Thank you for what you're doing. Now, a few years ago, I set up an organization called the Council for American Medical Innovation. And our thought was that we needed to bring together some of the stakeholders in medical innovation to try to get them to work together to advance the cause. And even though I didn't know a lot about it, I've learned a lot about it. Doesn't make me an expert, that's for sure. But I really learned a lot about the process of medical innovation. So we brought together all the biotech companies, the pharmaceutical companies, all the disease groups, the colleges and universities. We brought together other organizations interested in medical innovation, and we have tried to advance an agenda of some simple things that we think could help. And we've made some progress. I don't want to get carried away with it, but we at least have registered on the mind of some of our policymakers in Washington, people out in the states, governors and state legislators. And in the days and months ahead, we hope to make even more progress with medical innovation. And one of the most exciting things about it to me is that we're all doing these things at a time when we seem to be on the cusp of pretty enormous breakthroughs in finding answers to big problems. We all know the history of medical innovation. It's slow. The breakthroughs are spaced out pretty far apart, kind of uncommon. Difficult to get through all of the processes that you have to go through by necessity to produce something that's really going to solve a problem. Takes a lot of capital. A lot of it has to go into basic scientific research, which no one knows where it leads or what it will uncover. That's the nature of basic scientific research. And so it's been a tough area to deal in, but having said that, with the advent of the Genome Project and other advances that have been made in science, at least it's my elementary understanding that we're now on the threshold of really being able to address a lot of problems that we never thought we could address. And it always isn't a cure. Oftentimes it's better managing a condition. But hey, that's pretty good progress in and of itself. Look at what we do now with many diseases that 10, 20 years ago we couldn't even deal with. Now we can manage and extend life over 5, 10, sometimes longer number of years. Look at HIV/AIDS. I mean, it wasn't long ago that HIV/AIDS was a death sentence. I remember in the 80s going out to AIDS hospitals. You know, they segregated people because they had AIDS. And everybody thought that it was, you know, would transit between human beings. And everybody was scared to death. And if you got an AIDS diagnosis, it was lights out. Well, that's over. We haven't cured it, but we manage it because of medical innovation. We now have solid answers to really tough problems that needed to be answered. And so as I've delved into this, I even learned more about it and why medical innovation is such an important issue to address. And so I want you to, for a second, get into my shoes as a political figure or a former political figure who thinks about things from a political viewpoint and understand why I think this clump of issues is the most important thing facing our country and our world. Energy is important. I understand that. Global warming, you know, I'm from Missouri. We just had this big tornado out in Joplin, Missouri, killed 120 people. There's something going on in the environment. I'm not a scientist. I can't prove anything to anybody, but we got to pay attention. We got economic problems galore. You all know all the problems. In my entire career, I never saw an issue like medical innovation that would address three enormous goals or three enormous challenges for the country and its people at one time. At one time. First, it is fabulous economics. Fabulous economics. We used to always have these debates about how much of our GNP should we spend on healthcare. Well, we're kind of answering that with our feet. Used to be we spent 12% of GNP on healthcare, and then it was 13%, then it was 14%, then it was 16%, now it's 17%. We're told that in a few years it'll be 20%. Well, how much is the right figure? My answer is the people will decide that. And guess what? People want health. They want well-being. They want to be healthy more than they want any other thing. I always say to audiences, you could be Bill Gates, but if you lose your health, the money doesn't mean a thing. It's worthless. And so whether we have money or we don't have money, what we all most want is health, and we're willing to pay for it. Guess what? The people will decide this. Maybe we want to spend 30% of GDP on health and well-being. Might be better than spending it on gambling or, even new cars. It might be the best use of money. But again, it's people's decision. So if we've got 17% of GDP going into healthcare now, on its way to 20, you just know it's got to be good economics and good for the economy of the country. Come with me to St. Louis, where I'm from. We used to be a manufacturing town. We made shoes back in the early 1900s. None of you remember that, but we do. We don't make shoes anymore. We used to make cars in Missouri, in St. Louis. We had three big car plants. They're all gone. What's the biggest employer in St. Louis? Healthcare, by far. What's the biggest employer in Cincinnati? Healthcare, by far. Pittsburgh, New York, L.A., Denver. You can go down any city in the country. The number one employer in that city today is healthcare. So there's a wonderful flip side to the story of, oh, we're spending all this money. Yeah, we're spending it on ourselves and on our own economy. Pretty good thing. So medical innovation, which is at the heart of a robust healthcare system, is good for economics, good for jobs, good for giving people a decent living and a high standard of living. Second, we're all worried about healthcare costs. Every day we read about Paul Ryan's plan to cut Medicare or the president's plan to cut Medicare or somebody else's plan to cut Medicare and Medicaid and health care in general. What's the best way to reduce health care costs? It just happens to be medical innovation. Now, sometimes when you start an innovation and when you're trying to deliver it, it can cost more to the system because we don't quite have it perfected. It takes time to get it rolled out and so that it really is effective and works. But over time, imagine, just imagine how much money is saved by having answers to big problems. Think of the polio vaccine. I mean, it's inestimable how much money was saved in this society if we had not had the polio vaccine. Let me flash forward for you. So in this role as being involved with the Council for American Medical Innovation, I get to go to neat conferences like this and listen to people that are a thousand times smarter than I am and hear about the great things they're doing. And I recently went to a conference in Washington on regenerative medicine. And we heard about all kinds of efforts that are being made to try to regenerate parts of organs or whole organs and all the promise that they see. And so after the meeting, a young fellow came up to me and he said, I'm doing some work with kidney disease and I'm injecting, I think he meant stem cells, I'm not sure I'm right on that, but some kind of cells from your body into a dysfunctional kidney. And he's doing it on dogs now as an experimental matter here in the United States. And he's very hopeful that he'll be able to make great strides against kidney problems that exist in so many people. And then he said, about a month ago, I went over to China and talked to their scientists and their medical people, and they were stunned by what he was trying to do. And they said, well, why don't you use it on human beings? And he said, well, it's the United States, and we have all these, you know, procedures you have to go through. I got to go through animals, and then maybe I can show that it's viable, and we can go then to human beings. And the Chinese said, stop, go no further. We have no dialysis in this country. We have millions of people with kidney failure, kidney disease. So if you'll come here with your experiments, we'll build you a lab. We'll bring you thousands of people to use in your experiments, and we will advance this science as fast as we can. And as he was talking to me, I was connecting the dots because I remembered from my work on the Ways and Means Committee that dialysis, which is fully paid for, as you may know, by Medicare, we picked up the total national tab 25 years ago, I think properly, because this was a new technology and you couldn't get it going, people couldn't afford it, so we pay for it. It costs the Medicare budget $87 billion a year. A year. $87 billion a year. Now, if this works, and it may take a lot of time, and it may never work, who knows, but it may work, has potential. He's very encouraged. We could pretty well fix the Medicare problem with that one thing. So if anybody tries to argue to you that, oh, medical innovation is just a cost adder, it's never a cost subtractor, you just need to give them that anecdote and a number of other anecdotes that you can give them that just disprove that statement. That's a bad argument. It's not based on fact. We got to deal with facts. And the fact is medical innovation saves healthcare costs dramatically while it extends life with quality. What a win-win that is. You know, we once had a hearing out in when they were starting to do transplants. You remember that period? And we were, you know, Medicare was having to pay for transplants. And so once again, everybody was saying, we can't afford this. We, you know, if we give everybody a transplant, we're going to go broke. So we went out to Washington U in St. Louis and had a hearing on transplants. And we brought in all these transplant doctors. And we said, what you're doing is really neat, but, gee, it's just costing us too much. Don't you think we can't afford this? And the one doctor who was doing a lot of kidney transplants said, hey, you don't get it. People with bad kidneys don't just die. They live. and they live a horrible quality of life, and we spend millions to take care of them. So it's a bad deal. Yeah, this may cost 50 grand, whatever it is, to get the new kidneys in them, but then they can resume normal life. They can be productive citizens again. They can act in the economy. They can have a high quality of life. And so you have to put that cost up against the cost of maintaining their life in a poor form, which is the alternative. So I think this is the second big goal, and it's obvious that it cuts healthcare costs. And finally, medical innovation has led to probably the number one achievement of this healthcare system and this country over the last 50 years, and that is we've extended life with quality. Now, I'm getting old. When I was young, I remember clearly that when people hit 65, which I thought was like the other end of the cosmos, how could anybody be 65? People died. Do you remember? Is anybody here old enough to remember that? Am I losing my memory? People now live to 70 and 75 and 80 and 85 and 100. And my friends in medical innovation believe with all their heart that we're going to go past that and not too far in the future. With quality. With quality. What could be a more important goal than that? So, those are three overwhelming challenges, goals, that we meet with this one cluster of issues. Now let's talk about neurology, brain science, one mind, this project. So while all these things are going on that I've been talking about, and while we're making strides in medical innovation and science, probably the one area that has been left behind more than others, it hasn't been totally left behind, but left behind more than others, is neurology, brain science, whatever you want to call it. The whole set of issues dealing with the brain, with the nervous system. And there are probably some good reasons for that. I think, and I'm not a scientist, so what I'm going to say here will probably cause you to throw rotten tomatoes, and I may be well wrong, but it may be that the study of the brain is a little bit more complicated, maybe a little bit harder than studying other parts of the body. I don't know that, but I sense that maybe that's the case. Pretty complicated organ and system. Has a lot of stuff going on. And studying that and understanding how to impact it correctly, really hard. I have a friend who's the, and he may not want me to say this in public, but he's the head of the Department of Neurology at UCSF, and he's a great guy, and came from Harvard from around here, and he now runs it out there, and he's set up a whole center out there to do neurological studies. He once told me 2 or 3 years ago, he said, the problem with neurology is it's the black hole of medicine. He said, we just don't get enough effort, can't raise enough money, we don't know enough. We can't find enough answers. It's really a hard area to deal in. He said, that's what we have to change. And that is what we have to change. I think another reason that it's been that way is that probably the public, and all of you know this, look at some of these conditions as being the fault of the patient, not like other diseases. I mean, how many times have you heard that? And we've been afraid of it. Like it's different than cancer, or different than heart disease, or different than, hip displacement, or whatever. Patrick led this unbelievable fight with his father in the Congress, and they finally got mental health to be part of health care. By mandate, you have to have mental health coverage in health care policies. What a valiant fight that was. Why did they have to fight that hard? It's ridiculous. And I used to say to people, you think you have a health insurance policy that says if you have a problem with your big toe that it's not covered because it's your big toe? Well, the last I heard, your brain was part of your body. What's wrong with this? What's wrong with us? Why can't we understand this? So gradually we are, but that misunderstanding of what this is about, I think, has caused a lack of advancement in the science. People haven't wanted to attack this because it's been misunderstood, mischaracterized, and, in my view, maligned in ways that are wrong and unfair. So that brings us to this effort. This is going to be hard. There are a lot of parts to this. If it was just raising a bunch of money and putting money in, get the results out, that'd be easy. You know, I could help with that. I mean, I know how to. I think I know how to raise money. Patrick and I raised money for the DCCC for 2 years solid, and we can do that, and we'll do that. And a lot of you will help do that. But this is more complicated than that. This takes other reforms, other changes in behavior, other advancements outside of the box of the way we normally do things that will really be hard. Let me just tick off a couple that I have in my mind that I know you've probably been talking about. One is, how do you get the entities that do this research, whether they're private or public, to be in a place where they're more willing and able to share data, information, discovery, so that we can leverage what we're doing off of what someone else is doing? Now, we all know the reasons that's hard, and I fully accept that. We got a thing called intellectual property, and we have a great capitalist system, and I'm for it. I believe in it. I believe capitalism and profits are a great driver of human behavior, and I don't think we want to blow that up. But, again, we got an area here that's underserved, that's way behind, that has huge dividends to pay for the society beyond your estimation. So we've got now to think outside the box and get entities that haven't been looking at thinking outside the box to be willing to do that with us. Seems to me we've also got to talk about reform of governmental processes that affect this area, like maybe FDA reform. FDA is a fabulous organization, does yeoman work. People there are dedicated in their jobs and don't get paid nearly what they could get paid on the outside. I admire what they do, and they keep us safe from, you know, substances that will do us great harm, and they make sure that things that are produced are viable and really are going to do kind of what they said they're going to do, or try to do what they said they're going to do. But with the new science and all of the new targets that are available and what we now know about the cell structure and other structures, it may be that we need to change some of the procedures, quicken the procedures, talk about new ways of doing this. Maybe some of it even with the help of the private sector in an appropriate way so we can move this along and make better decisions. And since this science in some of these areas is so special and unique, it may be that the FDA needs some people from the outside who know that area well to help in looking at what's being presented in different areas. So So that's just two. I could name four or five others. I don't want to bore you today, but a lot of challenges in thinking outside the box and, more importantly, acting outside the box so that we can move this area strongly along. Now, let me kind of end with both the banner that we're putting around this, which I think is a very serious and important banner. And then I'm going to end with a couple of stories from my own family so that you know a little bit more about why I care about all this so much. Patrick's great idea, and he's a wonderful thinker and works with issues, but he's also a great political mind, and he understands how to get something across so that people can understand it and rally behind it and really care about it. And so from the beginning, and partly because of his work on the Armed Services Committee and his work with veterans, he, you know, well understood from his service the enormous problem of returning vets with all kinds of mental, neurological problems. And I got to tell you, I kind of knew it from reading about it and my service in Congress, but I didn't really understand it well until I went to a fundraiser for families of returning vets who had neurological mental problems, challenges. And Danny Inouye was there, senator from Hawaii. He's been in the Senate for a long, long time. World War II veteran, injured in the war, gravely injured. One arm doesn't work, and he was crippled and all kinds of problems. And when he got up to talk, he said, you know, what you're doing here is really important. He said, when I was injured in World War II, he was in one of the islands in the Pacific, he said, I laid on the ground, injured, bleeding, for 9 hours before anybody got to me. And I was one of the few that was injured who survived because it took so long in that war to get people to medical treatment. He said, in fact, the statistics are that in World War II, 20%, only 20% of the people injured in the field came out of the field. 80% died in the field. But he said, conversely, today in Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever, it's the flip. 80% come out, 20% stay in the field. But many of the 80% that are surviving are coming back with grave both physical and mental challenges. And that's why what Patrick is presenting as the kind of lead idea for this whole idea is so important. These young people who have gone to Iraq, who've gone to Afghanistan, who've gone to all these places, now in Libya, fighting for what we all believe are important things to do. We'll have disagreements on this war or that, but we've asked them to go, so they're there. They're volunteers. They're not draftees. They're going of their own volition. They're going because they think it's an important thing for the country. They're doing it for all the rest of us. And to have a young person come back with severe mental challenges, unable to function, what we have to understand is they're not just coming back having bad nightmares. They're unable to function at all. We have to have better answers for them. And everybody in the American community will support that with their mind and their heart and their money. And it's that goal that has to lead the way. Because as most of all of you know, these challenges, these problems are somehow interrelated probably. If we make progress on this, we'll make progress on that. This effort has to be led by our own desire to do right by these people. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. It's immoral to have them back here without help, living a zero life, not being able to do anything for their families of any kind. It's just wrong. And this effort will lead us along the path to solve that problem once and for all. Now, I have to end with two personal stories, and I always start this by saying we all have stories. So I'm not unique at all, but I think what I'm about to tell you will give you a little window into why I care so much about medical innovation. So my wife and I have three kids. In 1970, we had our first child, Matt. And in 1972, he was having some serious flu symptoms. Didn't seem to go away, so we took him over to Children's at Washington U, and they finally took some x-rays and found that he had a very large rhabdomyosarcoma on his prostate, which is very unusual. It's the third reported case of that kind. Rhabdos, I guess, are usually found on striated muscle behind the eye, and so when they saw this, they were really alarmed and frankly depressed, because they didn't think he had a chance. It had so invaded his abdominal cavity that it was cutting off his ability to urinate or do any. It was a real mess. And so they said, we really don't know what to do about this. We can't operate on it. It's too big. Radiation's probably not going to work either. We'll look for some chemo that has worked on the eye problem, but we don't know if that'll work. And this is an aggressive tumor. It'll metastasize, and you really don't have any chance here. Well, long story short, I don't want to bore you with the details. 5 years later of 11 operations, triple chemotherapy from MD Anderson and St. Jude, got the thing to shrink. Then they gave me max radiation. Matt's 40 right now, and he works with me every day in my business. I get it. I really get it. Nothing more important than this. So he came up here in 1981, 11 years after they took his bladder out, because it was all messed up. And so we had to have a new pull down, because his conduit was wearing out. And he had to have a bowel pull down, because the radiation had so harmed his bottom of his bowel that he couldn't use it. So they thought they were going to have to give him another bag, but they thought maybe this doctor in Boston, Hardy Hendren, who some of you may know, can do a bowel pull down while he does a new conduit. So we did 13 hours of surgery here at MGH, and so Matt, it all worked. It all worked. And I met Hardy Hendren and saw what he does, and I was just in awe. I mean, it made me feel like I'd wasted my life. This is such important stuff. So we got through that, and he's 40. And if you met him here today, you would know there was ever anything wrong with him. I then began to worry with my wife that he would have mental, you know, that kids would make fun of him, and he'd have all kinds of problems. And he just never did. I mean, Jane told him every day, you're the luckiest person in the world. And he believes it. And he is. He has this wonderful attitude. But as a result of that operation in 1981, the new conduit that was new in 1981 is now wearing out. And so his doctor recently told him, you don't have a lot of bowel left to do any more conduits. So we got to hope for some breakthroughs here on, you know, regeneration. So I go to this regeneration conference, another one, not this one, and I meet this guy from Wake Forest who has now made 20 bladders on a form out of stem cells and put them in people. And there's no rejection because it's your cells, and it works. And I thought, my God, I mean, here we are again needing medical innovation, and maybe this can, you know, solve this problem so he can be 50 instead of 40. So while all this is going on, I got to tell you about one other child, Chrissy, our second child, and she grew up in the middle of all this consternation over Matt. I mean, you know, I'm sure every night when she walked in, we were huddling over Matt trying to get him through some other crisis. And so she was always had problems as she came along and seemed irritated. And but, you know, we always thought, you know, Matt had the problem. Her problems are fine. She's okay. It's not to worry. Well, turns out when she's in college, she's diagnosed as bipolar, got severe depression and real bouts of difficulty, hard to get up in the morning and go to work. And in many ways, her problems equaled Matt's and then some. Now, thank God there are some medications for her condition, and with counseling and medications, she's doing pretty darn good, and I'm happy about that. But we got to do better. We got to do better, and we can do better. So my charge to all of you is stay hitched up behind Patrick. You got a leader that has no equal. Think out of the box. Be willing to think in new ways about how to get this water to go up the rope. And believe in the mission. Just as Americans believe that we could put a man on the moon, a person on the moon in 10 years, we can do this. Yes, we can. Thank you, and God bless you.